Good morning and welcome to ICBC Sex Addiction. This time it's going to be the Pain Lab section. As you all know, that ICBC stands for Informed Counselors by Cassettes. Now, we were thinking of changing that to videos there for the last part there, you know, Informed Counselors by Videos, but they realized then they'd have to change the ICBC logo and their letterhead, and Dan Rumberger would have to change his monographed, handkerchiefs and stuff like that, and Jim Gaskell would have to get a different license plate, you know, all those kinds of problems. So there, and besides that, you know, that some of the older members would just go on calling it ICBC anyway, you know, who could get them to change. So anyway, here we are, and we're going to do Pain Lab today. But while we're at this, I wanted to make a little point to all of you. Dan Rumberger, who some or maybe all of you know, has been working with me for better part of a year to get this presentation ready for all of you. He's had a real interest, a real concern that you get something out of the presentation on sexual addictions that will have some practical use to your lives and some real impact, and you'll understand enough about it to be able to usefully, you know, you kind of use the information and then today to have some practical things to do with it. Now, he's still, even at the end, of course, I'm responsible for what I brought to the table to do that. But he asked me how many hours we would need in order to be able to do that, and he designed this program around being able to do it. So if you like the effort that he made on that, I think it would be very, very good if you were to let him know that, you know, just thank him for the enormous amount of years' effort that he put into getting this program running for you. Now, if it didn't actually work at all, I'm fully responsible for that, and you can bring the complaints to me on that score. But he's done a lot to make this a possibility. I also wanted to say that 5 years ago, when I began to develop this material, the connection between attachment in the brain and sexual addiction, there wasn't anything on the subject at all. And so I sent a letter around to everybody that I knew in the field, and I said, could you send me the information that you have? And only one person responded to me, and she's here today, and that's Esther Johnson, if you'd mind standing up a second here. She's devoted her life, actually to working with people in this area. And where you might say I'm a tourist to the area, she's definitely someone who's spent their life working on this. And she sent me a very thick packet of very hard-to-read material that was the start of what we've been talking about here, and I've built the things based on that. So I want to thank you personally for making all of this sort of come together. And if you have any really difficult questions, she's the one to ask about it. All right. What we're going to talk about today is a catastrophic failure to reach adult maturity and how that leads to addictions. That's what we've been looking at all along. And to do that, we're going to start with what you do first if you want to deal with some kind of an addiction, in this particular case a sexual addiction. The first thing you want to do is find out the maturity level the person is at. If they're a child level maturity, that's the last level before you hit adult, right? That means you're close. You've already gotten very close to becoming an adult. And so the number of deficits you have are few because you got real close to it. And as a result, the addictions are relatively mild. And the solution for that kind of problem is what we'll be talking about today in terms of Pain Lab. Then if you're at late infant maturity, you realize you didn't quite make it out of infant maturity, but you almost did. That's the next level of difficulty in dealing with addictions, and that produces your moderate addictions. And we're also going to give you sort of a brief introduction on how you deal with those kinds of addictions and how you maintain people's motivation and feeling. Then there's the early infant level addictions, and those are the very severe ones. And those kinds of sexual addictions, we're not going to be really talking about what you do here because, that's just too much to do in the amount of time we have, and you will probably need more resources to deal with them than you probably have when you go home. So we're not going to deal with that. So let's start with helping sex addicts who are in late child maturity. And Pain Lab is for that. It's a step to help them get into adult maturity when they're quite close to it, and they just missed it by a little bit. Now, Pain Lab, you see, it is actually an experience in pain. It's learning to suffer well. Now, if you go into basic training in the military, you learn that basically what they do is they make you uncomfortable as all get out for a period of time, and during that time, they teach you to stay on track and do what you're supposed to do while you're uncomfortable and feeling miserable as all get out, right? So by the time you get done, you can remember your objective and keep doing it even when you feel terrible. So they put you in this environment of suffering, and you learn how to do what soldiers do when you're suffering. Now, we happen to actually have this wonderful promise from our master that he's going to ensure that all of us suffer, right? Now, you would think then, of course, that all of us who are faithfully wanting to follow him would decide, if that's what he's promised us, let's get around to doing it well. I mean, you can do it poorly or you can do it well, but you're going to do it. And so we should be, like, learning to do it well. Now, the average addict has never had anyone to train him how to do it well. So Pain Lab is basically an experience in that. How do you train somebody to do it well? So becoming an adult, then, we go over the checklist for infant tasks and needs. So you all had one chance to go over your checklist and see for yourself. Now, usually, now that I've been doing this for a little while, I can tell what level of maturity someone is at within about 3 minutes of starting to talk to them. Sometimes they really insist on my being aware of it earlier. But if I bother to look, I can usually figure it out with anybody within about 3 minutes of just having any kind of a conversation with them. Now, that doesn't mean I always try to. That's if I want to figure it out, I can. I personally prefer to not figure out people's maturity unless I have some reason to, because what do I want to know for? You know, but it isn't that hard to figure out. See, people immediately begin to share their motivational system with you. If you notice that they're worrying and we're doing all kinds of things out of fear or anxiety, or they don't seem to know what satisfies them and stuff like that, you're very quickly putting together information. But you do that on the basis of having yourself develop those capacities, because again, if you haven't developed them yourself, it's a blank in your mind, you don't notice the blank in somebody else's mind. For instance, once that you know that the brain has something to do with a problem, then you listen to the next person talk about it, and they don't mention the brain, you say to them, well, now, you didn't say anything about the brain. But if you never heard the brain had anything to do with it, I remember one time dealing with an international leader who taught on the subject of dissociation. And I said, well, you know, there's some interesting things the brain does during dissociation. He says, what's the brain got to do with it? This is a spiritual problem. You see? And it is a spiritual problem. But spiritual problems affect your body too, don't they? And body problems, you know, it's all, to me, it was in there. But this is how you begin to look at things. So you have to have this, some awareness. And so here we have the checklist. And if the people get through the infant list pretty well, then you do the checklist for child needs. Have they got that? And if those two are pretty well filled in, you see there are nobody who gets perfect report cards, right? When you're in first grade, it doesn't necessarily mean that you do everything at a first grade level. Some things you do at a second grade level, and some things you might not do at all. And at ninth grade, it's the same thing. You might still be, like me, spelling at a third grade level when you're at a ninth grade, you know? I was always told I'd never get anywhere because I couldn't spell. So that was because no one knew that spell checkers were going to get invented. Then you see, at that point, you look for healing for wounds. Because as soon as you find somebody who's stuck in their maturity, you find at whatever level they were stuck a pretty good indication of where they were hit by the bus. That's when something came into their life or was missing from their life that shouldn't have been there. And so we look at, when we're dealing with this, at people's wounds, you see. And of course, you should know by now that the way you look for people's wounds is to ask the Holy Spirit to guide you in that process. You know, and just go prying around. This is something that God opens up. But You do that at this point. It's part of becoming an adult. And then you do coaching for the tasks that they need. Now, this is the reason why Promise Keepers never got off the ground, because they wanted to coach all these people with broken legs on how to run. There wasn't a healing component to it. And so you have other people, however, that heal and heal and heal, and they've never coached anybody to do anything with what they got after they were healed. So we're looking at, if you want to deal with addictions, you have both things, the healing for wounds and the coaching for tasks. Now, there's going to mean also there's unmet needs in people's lives. And the place that people meet their unmet relational needs is in the spiritual family. That's where you go for that sort of thing. So what do you need to become an adult, right? You need your own group, don't you? You need to be part of a group identity. Where are you going to get a group? You don't have a group in your back pocket. Where is there a group that will make you one of them, and one of them in a significant way for the rest of your life, a permanent kind of a group to belong to? So you don't want to create, you know, therapy groups, because therapy groups are by definition a group that we will grow up and kill at the end of the group. See? That doesn't work for group identity. Let's grow one and kill it. You know? That's not the point. You need something that becomes your group for life. These are my people. And so we ask the question, who are my people? And as Christians, we should have an idea about that. A way that you put all of this together now is this pain lab exercise. The wounds that we're looking for healing, I'll just mention the most common kinds of wounds. The first one is an attachment wound. That's what we heard Neil talking about yesterday, and I've mentioned it a few times as well. There's attachment wound. It means that something is painful about your connection to the people that you love and should care about and who help you form your identity, the people who actually tell you who you are. Of these, one of the most common is a father wound. And so as soon as you start talking about attachment to your father, a lot of people start going into pain. There's also a mother wound. It is much harder to get people to be honest about, because since most people have a very obvious father wound, they're very loath to admit that there's something wrong in relationship with their mother, too, because they're getting now down near zero on their scorecard. Then there's a sexual wound, which a great deal has been mentioned about. But one of the things that you will find inevitably in sex addicts is that they've got sexual wounds as well. And most men, let's talk about the men's side of it first, most men do not identify a sexual wound as a wound. And I'll tell you why. Because sex addicts all feel that whatever they're sexually addicted to has got the good thing. What do I mean by the good thing? Well, for instance, men who are, let's say, obsessed with large breasts, they feel like those are the good things, and they're always kept out of their range, and someone else has the good thing, and if they could only have and possess the good thing, then they could have something good for themselves. But they're always searching for who and where is the good thing. And it's always out of their reach someplace. Some creature or somebody else has got it. And you're always in this pursuit for the good thing. Sexual wounds happen that way. Well, what happens? What happens with boys, let's say they're exposed to pornography, they have an intense emotional response to it, and everybody else goes around and goes, oh, lucky dog. All right? Now, if an older man molested a younger girl in the neighborhood, we'd all go, the pervert. Right? And I'm hauled off to... But if an older woman came along and did something sexual with a younger teenage guy in the neighborhood, all of the guys are coming around, lucky dog. No. And our culture is so set that it is very hard to admit to anybody that there's anything other than, you know, this is the good stuff. If you get pornography, all your friends will tell you, this is the good stuff. You know, hey, guess what? You got to see the good stuff. Well, what did he get to get? Everybody tells you this is the good stuff, but yet every time you do it, it doesn't give you good results. So what do you conclude? There's something wrong with me. It's a sexual wound, but no one recognizes it as such. And the advertising is so strong that you can get guys to pay good money for this wounding. Imagine that. They'll go and spend all kinds of good money to get wounded. All the time trying to figure out, why is it not giving me the good stuff? Maybe I'm just not getting the best of the good stuff. If I paid more, maybe I could get a higher quality good stuff. It's not working. It's a sexual wound. Then there's the contempt wound. You remember what Jesus said about the contempt wound? He said that anybody who has contempt for their brother is in danger of hellfire. It's soul murder. And we have made that into an art in our country of having contempt for people. And so if, you know, the simplest form is to look at somebody and say they're not cool. We have contempt for them. And we certainly have a lot of contempt for people with wounds. And if their wounds happen to make them less than the most beautiful form or do any of the other sorts of things, we just hold them as sort of beneath contempt. And that produces its own kind of death within us. And then we've got a Christian wound, which we should look at here. Now, I don't know if any of you have ever been around a church. But if you really talk to the people who stay away from church, and a great deal of non-Christians do, one of the big reasons they stay away from church is they've been wounded by a Christian. And when I talked with Christians, actually I find out that an awful number of the wounds in their own lives came from other Christians. They really weren't done by the local town atheist, you know? And this kind of Christian wound often carries with it in their mind a very bad reflection on God. And if it isn't on God, it's on God's people. And so, you know, unless we openly admit that there's a lot of Christian wounds, things that have really a huge impact on how we believe and relate to God, we don't get healing in those areas of our lives. So that's just a little catalog there on that. Dealing with these wounds, you know, is where we have this eight-step process that we were talking about yesterday of finding the upset, looking at the belief that goes with it. So you get the right and left hemisphere working together, asking the Holy Spirit to take you back to the best evidence, inviting Jesus into that evidence, testing the truth of your understanding by having God reveal the truth to you about whatever it is that's really hurting and bothering you. And then checking for afterwards for that peace and rest internally, because you see, if your brain is operating in truth, it will be peaceful. You see, even if the truth is not all that pleasant about you, you see. Now, so I broke my leg, right? Am I all that pleased that I have a broken leg? But if someone says to me, you know, you really can't get around too well with that broken leg, I feel understood. Yeah? Now, if you're in great shape and ready to run around and someone says to you, you know, you're really not getting along too well there. You got a broken leg? You know, you won't feel that great about it. You won't feel understood. And so even the difficult things about us, even when Jesus said to the woman at the well, yeah, well, you've had seven husbands and the one that you're with now isn't your husband. She looked at him and felt deeply understood, like, this guy knows, you know. And that is the sense of being really understood. It makes our whole brain run together nicely. You repeat that. If you still have other things that upset you, you give thanks. And remember, you can do that for whatever you can hold in your consciousness. These eight steps are here in the study guide as well, if you want to look into that. And those also have a complete list of all the maturity tasks and needs that we've been talking about. So if you want to assess maturity, that's a simple way to get it. Now, if you're looking at a way for coaching missing maturity, this is a book that I developed for the coaching task. How do you get a community to know what they need to develop in somebody in their different levels of maturity? That's beautiful when the whole church begins to work together on that score. And then when we begin to say, how do we move from being isolated individuals into being a spiritual family in which we can address each other's needs for belonging, we wrote this book on the life model, spiritual family. Now let's apply that directly to addictions and pain lab. It's a boot camp for suffering well. And it's going to teach you how to act like yourself under different emotions. What we're going to be doing is remembering what matters even when it hurts. So it's a time of focusing a person's mind. And the first thing that matters, as far as your brain is concerned, you remember the banana? It wants to be synchronized with somebody. It wants to be in a relationship. So the number one thing that we want to remember when we're hurting is we want to maintain relationship. And that is, of course, the first thing that blows out by people who run away from their pain. So you can say the entire purpose, really, of Pain Lab is to keep you in pain and to teach you to stay in relationship while you're in there. Now, does that mean you're not going to keep running away all the time? Well, you are going to keep running away all the time. You've been training your brain to run away all the time ever since you can remember it. And so it's got another real pattern to work with. But we're going to be chasing it down, lassoing it, and dragging it back. You know, so, okay, well, you ran away again. Okay, let's get you back. That's what it means to be staying in a relationship when you're upset. What relationships are we talking about? Your important people in your life, your personal people, your group identity people, and your relationship with? Aha. Uh-huh. And you know what? Your brain can only synchronize with one other person. I'll make a little observation. That means you can never get a group of people to get synchronized with each other at all. Because we can only do one other person. But suppose there was a mind greater than all of our other minds that could synchronize with a lot of people at the same time. It could do like, you know, hundreds or millions even, kind of one-on-one. Now, if everyone synchronized with that one greater mind, and we were designed to stay synchronized with one mind that was greater than all of us, then if that one mind happened to be intelligent and able to do things, you could find that everyone would be in synchronization with each other by staying synchronized with that one greater mind. It's sort of like the main hub for connecting all the little peripherals, you know? Now, if only there were a system like that, you know, wouldn't it just be great? Oh, let me back up. Then we are staying in relationships while we're upset. And those are the relationships and how we plan to stay in them by keeping hooked into a hub. And then we're strengthening child and infant skills because you've got some of them down. You might not do them too well, but things like making yourself understandable, you know, doing hard things, all those kinds of things, we're strengthening those by practice during this time. So if you've got some you know, remedial work to do, Pain Lab is remedial time on those skills. And there's no more avoiding discomfort from intimacy. So the conscious goal that we're putting people to in Pain Lab is you're going to stop avoiding the discomfort that intimacy brings. It's a six-month period of time in which you actively disable all your mechanisms for avoiding uncomfortable situations and feelings, which includes but is not limited to no drugs, alcohol, masturbation, sexually explicit materials, no withdrawing, lying, extended work hours, or use of recreation to avoid conflicts, no controlling others through threats, anger, or intense emotions. I might point out that for people with anger management problems, the same technique works pretty well straight across the board, again, if they're approaching adult maturity. If they're way down in their maturity, it doesn't work. But I use this just as effectively for spiritual pain management as I do for sexual addictions. The first 2 weeks are devoted to observing all the types of ways in which you avoid emotional pain. The wounds, the attachment pain, the big six emotions, all your fear-based motivation. We don't try to change a thing or do anything else. We just try to pay attention to them, log them, make a list, talk to other people. And I love to gather a group of people together that are going through this. Typically, although not exclusively, but typically I'll have a same gender group together, because if you put guys who are trying to face pain together with women, they typically just clam up and let the women do the talking. And so almost across the board, the women do all right and the men don't if you mix them together. And so just for the sake of things, I generally keep them separate. Every once in a while, I think it might work to have a couples group, and interesting. But you kind of better really be on your toes if you want to do that one. But you're beginning to look at these problems and have them catalog them and realize that all day long they're running from these feelings and these fears, and they're doing these things because they never stop to look at it. And if the immediate thing you do is as soon as you look at it, you jump on their case about it, they begin to figure out ways to not notice. Because, you know, they feel like, well, you know, what am I supposed to do about it? I'd rather not pay attention. So for 2 weeks, you do nothing but pay attention to the whole thing. Look at it. You know what that does? Remember that flashlight of attention? It puts the flashlight of attention on them for the first time in the middle of their distress and says, you know what, you're interesting. You're so interesting, I don't need to change you right now. I just want to get to know you. And that's a very important message. If you continue to send the message that they've heard all their life, and that is, you know, change today or even sooner, they will never find themselves interesting, and they will not begin learning about themselves. Remember the prefrontal cortex? It's curious, it's creative. You're trying to get the prefrontal cortex up and running and looking at themselves, learning to say, you're interesting, you're worth getting to know. And we should spend at least 2 weeks doing that. Week three through the end of the third month, your notes might say week two, I don't know. Week three, because if you count the first 2 weeks doing this, then the third week, through the end of the third month is devoted to actively resisting all known and newly found ways to avoid powerful emotions and fear. Because, you know, they're just so creative. We're dealing with this. As soon as you start shutting down the ways you do, you find new ways to do it. And so you got to notice and observe them, and it's just wonderful. You know, in fact, this is one of the first hopeful things. You know, they find a new way to do it, and you point out to them, you know what, you're being creative. You're creatively problem-solving in this area. Proves you can do it. You just found another way to get out of here, you know. And we're going to use that same creativity now as you get better used to it, and we're going to find ways to use that to your advantage. But it's the first time they realize they can be creative in this area that they've been in pain in. And of course, their first creativity is always in the escape category, but it doesn't matter. They're now activating that part of their mind and starting to look at it. The objective is to locate and feel as intensely as possible all discomforting emotions. That is mind-blowing to people who've been running from them for 50, 30, 80 years, however it might be. You focus on each emotion. Here's what you do when you catch it. You focus on each emotion as it appears and feel it as strongly as possible until it disappears on its own. You should do that at least 10 times a day and up to 200 times a day on weekends or in times of strong feeling. So if the feeling was anger or whatever else they might be catching up there, I say, okay, well, the thing to do is sit down right now and feel just as angry as you can. You know, just go for the top. Blow the lid out of your mind. If it's fear, feel the fear as strongly as you can. Or if whatever it is, just amplify that fear and get it to go. The funny thing is that as soon as you start amplifying the fear and feeling it as strongly as you can, your brain quickly begins to resolve it. And again, this is when it starts to resolve within 90 seconds. I'll describe what happens to you the first time you do that. The first time you do that, I get guys or women as well, same thing. I say, okay, now you're going to feel that feeling just as strongly as you can. I'm going to check my watch here, and I'm going to see how long you can keep it going. And what's going to happen is you're going to feel at first like you're going to lose your mind. You're going to go completely stark raving crazy, and then it's going to feel like it's going to go on this way forever, and you'll never, ever, ever come back. And then going on that way forever is going to be over before the 90 seconds are. So you tell me when you've got it to the peak feeling. Just lift your finger. And so they sit there, they start thinking about it, and then they got the peak feeling. Why does it feel like it's going to go on forever? Your brain has never been this way before. There's no previous memory trace of any kind to say, here's what will happen next. And so as a result, it predicts there is no place after this. This is the end of the world. I came and I arrived. The second time you do this, you'll have a faint sense that this is this is a little bit familiar. You think you're probably going to lose your mind, and this could go on forever. The third time, you won't be able to feel like you're losing your mind, and you'll hardly get to the point where it's going to go on forever before you're starting to grin on your face. You know, like, oh yeah. Because now your brain has done it three times. It's got some memory of doing this before. So I know how to do this. And after that, there's this enormous relief. We do this with all the feelings. We just chase them down, and we train the brain to do something that was never done before. And once you know that this is how the process feels, then you know you're doing it right. And repeated practice is very beneficial. So the more times you get mad during the day, the better. You see, one of the problems we have with fire setters, people who build light fires, is they'll only usually do that about four times a year. And so it's very hard to catch them doing it, to realize what they're doing during the time and to feel it. But people who are sex addicts, they do it all the time. It's not uncommon for them really to have 200 self-produced orgasms in a day. That doesn't wear you out just thinking about it. That gives you lots of time to practice. This feeling's going to keep coming up and up and up and up and up. And if you're practicing 200 times a day, you're going to be learning really fast. And that's one of the benefits of having something that's always in your face. So don't say, well, it's a terrible problem. He says, this is a wonderful learning opportunity right here. The next thing we do is we tame the nucleus accumbens. You know, that part that screams, I'm going to die unless I get my fix. And the objective is to, in this case, consider it instead of deprivation, which you've always told yourself it was. I'm going to die. I'm depriving myself of that, the good thing, to begin to learn to do this as a form of sacrifice. I am not giving myself this in order to get something better. You know, I'm going for the steak, not the bone. And the idea that this is sacrificing, I'm giving up something for a better thing, is what you have to repeatedly tell the nucleus accumbens while it's carrying on. No, I don't want rocks turned into bread. I want real food that gives me life. That kind of training. And of course, if you don't know what brings you life, you're in a terrible spot, and that's why you need to be surrounded with people who do. During the time, it's also important to increase the amount of input you receive by being truthful to others about the things you normally hide from them for your own comfort. And this exercise should be guided by two principles. One, you must say the things you fear to say. So we're looking at fear motives and the things that people do to hide. And to begin with, the best place to try telling these things is to your discipleship mentor, the person who's discipling you or praying for you, or your what we call accountability group. Now, accountability groups can mean so many different things that, you know, I hesitate to even use the word. But if we talk about honesty groups, you know, in this case, you tell them what you would be afraid to tell somebody. Well, you know, this is the case. And the second principle is the objective is to feel your own feelings and not upset others and make them feel your feelings for you. Because if you go home and you begin to tell your wife, husband, and other partners and people in your family a lot of your feelings early on, what you'll be doing actually is upsetting them, and then they'll run around upset instead of you. And that's completely unhelpful to the points of this exercise. We want you to have practice being upset. So you want to be able to tell your upsetting things to people who aren't going to just, you know, it'll be like tag and they'll run off upset next, and you'll have to put out their fire. But eventually, in this process, it does come down to beginning to tell the people who are the intimate people in your life, the ones that you are afraid to actually tell who you are, the truth about who you are. Now, is the truth about who you are that you are a sex addict? Then the last 3 months of the six are devoted to the continuation of the painful feelings, but now there should be considerably less time spent trying to avoid the pain and increasing ability to and pride in your ability to feel your own feelings and act like yourself. So once you begin to experience these feelings and stuff like that, now we are trying to develop some style. Okay, now you've learned you can get through with it. Let's start to get through with it with some style. Now that you realize, hey, I'm really missing closeness with my wife right now, let's go home and instead of just going home and saying, you know, why don't you spend some time with me? I miss you. Let's do it with a little style. You know, how would you like to really express yourself? What would you like to have as a legacy? In terms of your way of expressing these things. Now, if you're still trying hard at that point, by the end of 3 months, to avoid feelings or avoiding them without much effort, by the end of the 4th month, let's say, then you should get professional help to overcome your avoidance. You're basically hiring a wrangler to rope you in, you know. And you want somebody with a little experience chasing down people who are good at running away. And the best way to hire them generally is to get a counselor. Every once in a while, you'll find it doesn't necessarily have to be a professional counselor, because sometimes there's some people who just, you know, they're lay counselors, they're very good at this, and they just rope people for the fun of it, you know. But you got to get somebody who's, you know, roped for a while, and they're going to get you on that one. Now, the overall objective is to remove fear-based actions and reactions that result in avoidance, concealing, threatening, controlling, and replace them with desire-based behavior. We're trying basically to convert a brain that runs under fear into one that runs under desire. Fear, though we haven't had a chance to talk about it, is directed out of the back half of your brain and the lower brain structures. We're trying to get people to move up in their prefrontal cortex, their identity center, and replace avoiding, concealing, threatening, and controlling with desire-based behavior. And by the end of 6 months, you should be doing things that are deeply meaningful to you, even when they require feeling unpleasant feelings. And your relationship should be characterized by pursuing desirable goals and not avoiding unpleasant experiences. Now, so who is this applicable for? Well, very often it's pastors and leaders and counselors and people in position of some authority. And they've been pretty good at hiding certain areas of their lives. Why do they hide certain areas of their lives? Because they're afraid. And when it comes right down to it, their deepest relationships are still being steered and guided by fear. You're basically helping them to find a way out of that fear. Now, on the way, you want to apply every last thing you've learned about dealing with deliverance, dealing with healing, dealing with prayer, dealing with nutrition, dealing with all of the things that go around this that you have generally available. I'm not saying that you do this neglecting all of those things. I remember this little sequence here is just to talk about the thing that we want to add to all of the other implements that you have. So this is not instead of that. This is in addition to that. In the middle of all of this process, people should be working on their relationship with God and with others and stuff like that, but with a focus, in this particular case, of learning to suffer well and face the emotions that they run away from that cause them to be afraid. There's only one thing in the world that we're afraid of: our own feelings. If it wasn't for the way it upsets us, we would never be afraid of anything. If I could give you any experience at all, and I said it won't be upsetting for you in the slightest bit, you would have no fear about it. We really fear nothing other than our own emotions, our own feelings, our own sense of pain. That is where every single fear comes from, and it's never on the outside of us. All things on the outside of us may cause it to start, but it is our own capacity to handle our own fears, our own pain, is the only thing that we fear, and the only thing that stimulates fear in the brain. So once you can stop running away from your own feelings, there is nothing left to be afraid of, folks. That's Pain Lab. So we're trying to convert fear bonds to love bonds. So if you want to change fear to love, you have to realize that fear bonds form from failed attempts at self-preservation. That's why people are in fear, because whatever they tried to do didn't seem to help with their self-preservation. Avoiding pain becomes self-preservation when unpleasant emotions are too intense to be quieted. So that's when you decide, I need a better solution here. I'm now too upset and I don't know how to quiet this. And so now we begin to avoid the pain. And avoiding pain stays the central focus of fear bonds long after the risk of overwhelming our capacities are gone. What that means is that you may learn to fear, well, I might learn to fear my mother or my father as a child. But long after their capacity to really overwhelm me is gone, I'm still running around avoiding them. I'm not telling them what's going on inside. I could handle it now. I couldn't handle it maybe when I was 3, but I'm still carrying that avoidance around with me. And now I'm avoiding my wife when she seems to resemble a little bit of what they did and all that. I'm avoiding things that I could handle because avoiding the pain has become the focus. And so what we're trying to do is get people to head right back into the pain. Is it self-preservation if I stop being and acting like myself? Has myself really been preserved? So you see, with fear bonds, they typically show up in two different forms. One is what we would call the inadequate person. And inadequate people you recognize usually as afraid because they're placating, withdrawing, and pleasing. Now, we don't always recognize the pleasing ones as afraid, But a lot of people please everybody else because they're afraid of what will happen if they don't please everybody else. And although we love to exploit them, they're fear all the same. Then there's the controlling bunch, and that's the bunch that we usually don't like unless we're hiring a senior pastor. And there can be intimidating, bossing, and domineering. But intimidating, bossing, and domineering is fear-based behavior. If they're avoiding intimacy, they're avoiding a chance that you're going to overwhelm them with your feelings, and they'll be overwhelmed by their own by making sure they get you to do only the predictable things so nothing you do will upset them. And God help you if you should upset them, because then they back up the truck. That's how they control. These are both fear bond systems. Remember, with addictions, we're looking at the failure to reach adult maturity and deal with the nuclear accumbens and return to joy from shame and the other big six feelings. It's those big six feelings that people are afraid of. It's always them. It's not anything else. Unless it's attachment pain, which is the biggest of the pain. So now you've got the list of things that people run from. It's attachment pain and the big six feelings. That's all it's got to chase you around. They're all internal. They're all a part of you. They can be set off by other people, but they are you. So how do you change fear to a love bond? Well, here's what an infant would do with it. They'd recognize the fear. You'd have to teach them what they're really afraid of. They'd have to learn to know who I want with me when I'm afraid. So you have to have, the first thing you have to do to get over fear is to become relational again. Who do I want with me when I'm afraid? And then you'd want to discover what I want or desire, because you can't do a desire unless you know what you desire. But infants don't know. They have to be told. And then they have to be taught to talk about it. Now you'll realize already here's what a lot of people don't do. They don't know. They don't notice the fear. They don't recognize it. They don't know who they want with them. They have no idea what they really, what would really satisfy them, what they desire, and they don't talk about it. To change fear into a love bond, if you're at a child level, you have to do some more things. You have to learn some more things. You have to recognize your part of the fearful situation, recognize the other person's part of the fearful situation. So you have to figure out which is my part and which is your part. Infants can't do that. You use a third person to check your reality. Did I get it right when I separated out my part and your part? And keep those separated. And then I learned to be myself rather than control you. So you see people who have become either controlling or compliant, either one have failed that task. The last one. They're not being themselves if they're pleasing everybody else. And they are not being themselves if they're controlling everybody else. They're trying to avoid feelings instead. Now, as adult maturity, we add some more tasks to the whole thing of changing fear to love. You stay in a relationship while letting others have their fears. You do nothing about what others fear, and you let them handle it. What are they handling? Their own feelings inside, right? It's up to them to learn how to handle those feelings inside. You take care of your own business with a personal style, meanwhile. And you remind yourself and others about your mutual goals and desires while you are solving this fearful situation. Now, there's a huge separation at this point between adult and below, and the next two levels, parents and above. So there's a huge dividing line in what happens here. Up until now, up until you reach adult maturity, you're taking care of yourself and not the other person. But when you get to parent and above, there's a huge shift in what happens. You see, these are counselor tasks. They're at least parent level maturity. You help the people assigned to you. You take some shared responsibility for helping children and infants face their fears. You see how that doesn't work at any of the lower responsibilities? You are working to make sure you find out which is your part. Now you've figured out what your part is, and you handle that so well, you've got some time and energy left over to help them with their part while they're figuring it out. You're putting the flashlight on them. You identify the fears in younger minds and help younger minds return to joy and peace. Then the church tasks, which require elder maturity, is to help people at risk who are isolated and marginalized with their fears. You help identify community fears. And you help the community remember what it's like us to do and remain a non-anxious presence so that in the middle of all of that, people know that you are not disturbed. You've not lost any of your relational capacity, no matter how scary it gets. So, our goal then with dealing with addicts, now that we've looked at the developmental components, the adult maturity solution is the goal that we're trying to get addicts to reach. And that is, we would say to them, we want you to confidently be yourself. Take care of your business. Stay in relationship with others around you who are anxious but do nothing about their part of the problem. And speak of mutually important goals during the times of threat and fear. That's what you're going to be helping people to do during a pain lab. Now, if you're dealing with children, child level maturity, they can't do all of those things. So here's what you're going to have to help them to do if you're helping them take their next step. You have to help them define clearly what's their responsibility and what isn't. See, until you understand that, you can't just go ahead and be yourself in the presence of a problem. Which part of it is my part of the problem? So you'll have to make sure that they're not being controlled by somebody else's upsets, threats, or fears and feelings, because that happens an awful lot. People running around being controlled by somebody else. You have to be careful not to control others with their upset feelings and fears. And if they tend to be in leadership, that's what they'll tend to do. Now, if you're dealing with infant maturity, you have to help others, have others help you discover what I'm really afraid of this time. Because everyone else knows that they're afraid, and the person themselves is clueless about it yet. So, yeah, you're afraid, and let's figure out what you're afraid of. I'm not afraid of anything. You know, well, what are you doing all this controlling for? What controlling, you know? I'm just doing, you know, God's will and stuff like that. I learn what's good for me to be when I'm afraid. Yeah, no idea how I act like myself. What's a good way for me to be when I'm afraid? I discover what I really want and need. You say, well, what is it you really need and want when, you know, you're afraid of it in a relationship? Well, I don't know. And so you have to discover that. You have to learn to talk directly with others about your fears and needs. Because, you know, unless you talk about it directly, you're not going to solve this problem together or sort out which is your part and which is their part. And often people have never learned to even put it into words. Or they can do it sometimes if they leave the room. They can tell you what they're afraid of, but when they're actually with a person, they've never heard or seen anyone else directly say to anybody else what they felt and needed. So often the first step is to say, well, what would you tell somebody else if you were telling them about it? Well, I'd tell them this and this and this and this and this and this. Well, have you ever thought of telling the person directly? And then they're like deer in the headlight. Okay, now we're going to look quickly at helping sex addicts who are at late infant maturity. This is the easy part now. We've dealt with the mild, you know, this is a way to work with those who are at a mild level of addiction. Now let's head into something a little bit messier, the people at a moderate level of addiction. And the first thing, this comes from Raymond Jones' work, and he and I are writing on this subject together and working on things, is what he calls the average guy scale. And so you say, okay, so you like internet porn, all right? How often do you think the average guy, clicks on the internet and sees a little porn? All right? And how severe are the consequences to that for the average guy? And what purpose does it serve? What does he get out of it? Now, suppose that the guy, you'd say, well, just not an average guy. He's got sort of a problem. You know, a moderate problem, not really a bad problem, but he's got sort of a problem with internet porn. How often do you think he'd be doing it? And what would he be doing, you know? And what would the consequences be for that? How severe would that, you know, that be? And what purpose would it serve? Why would a guy go from, you know, what an average guy would do up to kind of this level, you see? But now, extreme problem. You said someone got a really, really bad problem with internet porn. What would that be like? What would be going on? What would be the consequences of that? And what purpose would it serve? And what you're beginning to do is help the person realize that there are motives to this thing. There's a reason behind it. There's actually, things can get worse and better. Not everything, because up until now, they're just focused on their own stuff. There's no perspective to it at all. It's like, put yourself in a little perspective, you know, on these things. And you go down all of the different behaviors that they might have. Well, now I'll talk about phone sex. How often do you think that the average guy, goes out exposing himself? How often do you think the average guy goes out peeking in other people's windows? How often does the average guy, and we start running down all the list of the things that they're doing, how often does the average guy masturbate in parking lots? Whatever the thing is. And then what would be a moderate problem? And what would be an extreme problem? And you're realizing, again, we're talking about the very part of your brain that creates your reality. And so the first time we're starting to bring other points of view into looking at that reality on some kind of a grid that you can talk with. Because what we're trying to find is their motivation to recover. And then we look at those problems that they've given us and we say, how serious would you think your problem is on a scale from 0 to 10? 0 wouldn't be very serious and 10 would be very serious. So now we, instead of just having one problem, I've got a problem with porn, we've got maybe 6 or 7 or 8 different things or 20 things or 50 things, whatever the case might be that he does. And we go through and we say, how serious are those? Yeah, well, the phone sex, that's not real serious, but, the picking up male prostitutes in the park, I'm going to get myself killed there, It's just, that's pretty serious. And plus that, if I ever get caught at that, I'm going to lose my job as worship leader at the church. I'm quoting from an actual conversation I had with somebody at this point. How confident are you that you can make the change on the scale? So let's look at that. Talk about picking up the male prostitutes in the park. How confident are you that you can make that scale, that change? You can change that area of your life. And very often you find a very peculiar thing. You say that people realize the problem is very severe, but their confidence that they can change it is very low, like zero. Like there's just no possible way I can change that. And the motivation that they have equals the seriousness times the confidence. So if you have a seriousness of 10 and a confidence of 0, your motivation is 0. And all of a sudden you have to realize why certain problems they can look at and they say, that's huge, I can do nothing about it, and you've got exactly what they're going to do about it. All of a sudden it starts to make sense to them as well. Why is it that I can see a huge problem and I can't do anything about it? It's my motivational system isn't there. I've got nothing with which to motivate myself to go. So then we do this problem review area. Now let's take all those problems and let's put them in a list. What are the problems that are too hard to change? Put them on that list. And as Neil suggested to us yesterday, don't do anything about them. What are the problems that you might be able to change? Put them on the list. And the problems that are very easy to change. And you're probably going to start with the problems that are very easy to change because these are the roots actually that go in to feed the problem in its center core. And as they begin to experience that the roots that are feeding the problem are being cut off, the actual strength of these the problems that are impossible to change begins to decrease and drains out of that system. But during the meanwhile, you can try, if you love to waste your breath and help them to feel hopeless, you can try to tell them to change the problems that they have no motivation to change. And you won't get anything from it. But on the problems that are easy to change and might be able to change, you begin to move in from that area. That's where you're helping them with the things that they have the motives to be able to work on. And then, because we're not dumb, we will have them tell us what the pitfalls are. First, we ask them, what would it be like if you succeed? So we have in our idea what they're thinking they're actually going to get to. What they think they're going to be able to achieve here. And sometimes you look at what they think it'd be like when they succeed and you realize, boy, if they get over there, we're going to be in trouble. I had one fellow who's all of his sexual addictions, he was married, had children and all of that, and was a church leader. All of his addictions were homosexual. So I said, what would it be like if you succeeded? Well, the picture he painted to me was the worst lust problem for women I think I would have ever seen walk in my office. That's to him was what success looked like. I went to myself, oh, my goodness, please save us from that one. So it's good to know what it thinks, they think it would look like if you succeed. What changes would you hope for? Now you begin to look at what would their internal hopes be like. And then you ask, what would go wrong if you tried to change? What would happen? And now you're beginning to look at the things that they would anticipate. Well, you know, if I really start changing this, this part of my life is going to be in trouble, and that part of my life is going to be in trouble. And then you said, what could you do that would make you fail or sabotage your progress? And now you've got their what they're going to do on the table to start talking about it. Because then when they start doing that 2 weeks later, you can say to them, yeah, I remember you said this. You said this is exactly what you would do if you wanted to fail or sabotage your progress. What do you suppose the motives are here? Let's find you interesting right now. See, because you want to put the flashlight back on them. This is very interesting right now. Look at what you're doing here. You're doing exactly what you would do. Now, it's question time, and I'm going to allow myself the first question. And the first question is now, what is it that I'm supposed to do when I go out of here facing this huge problem and the meager resources and the tiny itty bit of training that I've had and the slight things I have to work with? Because, you know, I've come to really kind of understand the problem. I've got a few things I can work with. I've got a starting place. But, you know, where I'm going back to, the people don't know this stuff. They don't listen to me if I would try to explain it to them. I get no one that I could kind of get to work with on this particular subject matter. And what do I do with that? Now, you think I'm asking you your question, right, perhaps? All right. Let me put it this way. I have invitations to speak all over the world, but I have yet to be asked to speak on this subject in Southern California, in the area where I live. And in fact, although I have a church with a recovery program, to date, I have never been invited even once to talk to the recovery program in my church about any of these subjects. And if I went to talk with my church leadership about maturity, they would look at me like I had my eyes crossed, and they said, yeah, I remember Wilder talks about that, and that would be the end of the whole thing, you see. So you anticipate that we as leaders go back to a world that is full of all these resources and all these wonderful things available to us, and that we go back to where, you know, there are elders falling out of all the trees and people with all this maturity and all these wonderful bananas, and, you know, we just sit around having banana splits all day and going, oh, isn't this gorgeous life, you see. But we are all in pretty much the same boat, you see. Now, in a sense, we're the ones that know about this. And we may not see anybody else that knows about this for 2 years. Except we happen to all know the person who designed the brain, the program, the life that we are to live, the church that we're to join. And the only way that I can offer you a way out of this is the way that I'm going to use when I go home, and that is to pray to the Lord of the harvest, to the one who causes and creates spiritual family, to provide and create out of what he has in his storehouse the resources that we need to begin to work with whatever he wants to have grow where we are. And other than that, I would suggest that we want to encourage each other. You see, the people that have been doing spiritual warfare and inner healing and all the rest of that are a tired bunch. And so, if this has been a blessing to you, I'd suggest that every time you think of ICBC, you send a card to Dan Rumberger and tell him what a joy it was to have anything you took home, or say something to the people around. And you know, the people who come in for inner healing and spiritual warfare and that are a tired bunch. And so when you see them, or you encounter them, or you think about them, send them a card or a phone call or an email or just a smile. To say, you know, I'm glad you're still struggling with me. And you know what? We've talked about the addicts today. You could talk or turn around and say exactly the same thing I've said about all of their families and relatives and all of those who have been nailed by their behaviors and stuff like that. They're not any better, really, at getting back to joy. No one gave all the relatives of sex addicts wonderful bananas with which to recover from all of this. Wonderful elders, wonderful resources, wonderful places in which to learn how to act like yourself. Wonderful group identities. So they're all doing so well. They're all suffering the same way. And so what we have now is a basic thing to say. We begin to understand why our master might have said that I came teaching you this stuff so that my joy might be in you and your joy might be full. And until we begin to practice that full first step of building each other's joy and being glad to be together at all, we won't really develop any of what it takes to be together when we're suffering, and we'll be of no use to each other, to the people who come to us as counselees or the people we go to as counselors. We need to build each other's joy first and primarily because that's what we are meant to be, because that's what our master designed us for, that's what he called us for, and so let's do that first step because we all know enough to at least smile at somebody when we get home and begin to build these joys where we have it and pray that the Lord will send the rest of the things that we need. Next question. Yes.
What kind of encouragement do you give to somebody who feels that their addiction is truly their only coping mechanism they had because they'll never get from a partner what they want? You know what I mean?
Okay. What level of maturity are they at?
Probably almost adult.
Almost adult maturity. Mm-hmm. If they're at almost adult maturity, I would probably say to them, why are you afraid? Are we talking about a man or a woman?
I'm talking about me. That makes it easy. Nah.
Then I'll answer your question after we get done. So I don't answer personal questions in conferences. Yeah, yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
It's a good one there. It's a good one there, but we're going to have to pass on that one for the sake of the tape. All right. And another question. Yes. All right, the question, if I repeat it for the tape, is it sounds sometimes that I'm talking about having something resembling a homunculus inside, and how do I keep this from being reductionistic and deterministic, that this is what's going on. And again, and not to address this to you personally, but part of the problem is going to be the maturity level at which you are listening to this lecture. If you are listening to the lecture at a child maturity level or less, you'll keep thinking of this in either-or kinds of terms. At an adult level, you begin to think of this in terms of both and all the kinds of things that are going on, you see. And if it's reductionistic, you say, all you've got is your brain. And this is what's the controlling factor and what's going on. If you're looking at it from a less reductionistic point of view, I would say to you, the part of this you haven't been paying attention to or knowing very much about is your brain. I paid no attention to my leg until it was broken. I mean, I've lived with my leg the whole time. Ever since then, I've had to pay a lot of attention to what to do with a broken leg so that eventually I'll recover from it. Now, is that reductionistic? Is that being less than spiritual because I have a broken leg, I have to therefore pay attention to what it is? I say, no, God designed legs. He designed our bodies. He had a reason for us to be living in physical bodies, even fallen physical bodies. Personally, if I was in charge, I would have done it a different way. But that's why I'm not installed as God, you see. I don't understand why he didn't just finish the whole thing right there in the garden and say, okay, well, you know, why will we let all of these years run through? He has a plan, and I don't know what it is, but I'm participating in that. And so the only thing that keeps me from being reductionistic is to say, God had a reason for building a body. Now, the same thing applies to the church, you see, because people will say to me, well, shouldn't you take all your healing to God? If God, And in fact, you could hear that if you didn't listen to Neil carefully last time. You could hear Neil saying that all you have to do with your attachment is to go to God and bond with God, and then it's over with. There's no real need for a church. God had no real purpose for putting people in your lives. But then that would be reductionistic too, to say all that happens is between us and God. Well, it isn't all that happens is between us and God. You see, if you don't get the part with God right, you can forget the rest of it. But it all fits together. And so the only way I can say it is to say, for whatever reasons, God did create us with a brain, and a brain does have specific functions to it. And during this week, two of my good friends have had their brains shut down on them, and they're now in glory. And so we have to accommodate to the fact that brains do stop. They do not work sometimes. And we take that seriously. And we ought to take it seriously not just when they go to glory, but in terms of their limitations and how to build with them. And from my perspective, I think God has given us a way to continue to grow and build back in our bodies, our health, our minds, and our physical being, some of what he meant us to be, so that there's good news at all of those levels as we walk around in the world that he created to be. So that's about as well as I can handle that. Now, let's see. Do I have any time left? A little time left? Any other questions? I know it's not a good answer. Yeah. Okay, question here. How does overall emotional development compare to spiritual development? I would say that by design, there's no difference. If you want to know what God was after, he didn't want people with enormous spiritual abilities and no emotional or relational abilities. This couldn't have been a good idea. In actual practice, we find non-believers who have worked on their own maturity and are a whole lot more mature, having had done no interaction with God at all, but in their own emotional maturity are far ahead of what we have some very gifted leaders doing. Now, here's the funny thing. You know what it means to have a gift, a spiritual gift? It means you've received something that isn't yours by nature. And so when we receive spiritual gifts, we're receiving things that really weren't. It's God working in us, right? That's what it means to have a gift. Maturity means that we developed what God gave us by nature. And so you can develop a lot of that. The only problem is you have all this maturity that isn't full of life and it isn't life-giving until you bring it, the life of God, into it. You know, as one person said to me, you know, you therapists, because at the time I was a therapist, he said, you know, what do you do? Well, it's Thomas Gerlach, the German theologian who loves to torment me. So what do you do? Well, we help people to grow really strong personalities. He said, well, you know, do therapists bring them to the Lord? I said, well, if they want to, and if not, you know, they don't. He said, so you tell me that, what's your conversion rate? It's pretty low. So he says, you're building strong enemies for God then, aren't you? And that's, in fact, what you have. You have a lot of maturity. You have built a lot of strength. But if it's not full of life and it's not synchronized with God, it's not bringing life into the world. Without that synchronization of our whole being under the Lordship and in harmony with the Spirit of God, so that we only do that thing which God is doing, our maturity is not serving to bring life. And that is where it comes together with me. I'm pretty clear that there are no spiritual gifts of maturity. You can't pray maturity onto somebody. You can't lay it on by hands. It's always our work. And we are to work at that. And it is hard work. It's the hardest work we're capable of doing. It doesn't bring salvation. Yes.
Is it ever excusable?
Okay.
All right.
We'll go to the limits of what Christendom will usually let us talk about here, and we'll talk about what's normal and what's release in masturbation, and particularly as it relates to males. And well, I can't pull up the slides on the subject because they're someplace else in a different file. But basically, the area of your brain that's involved with the stimulation to your genitals is the area that's closest to the banana, the cingulate cortex, and the synchronization cortex. What your sexuality is designed to do by the wiring is to synchronize energy states with somebody else who's glad to be with you. The problem about masturbation, no matter which way you add it up, is that it is synchronizing energy with nobody else, and you have not learned to match energy levels with anybody else. And as soon as you try to move from that, now you realize your brain gets trained according to the experiences it has. And after a while, it deletes the things that it didn't use. If you train yourself to do that, have you had a joy experience at the end of it? Was anyone actually glad to be with you? Not unless you trained yourself to stay in some kind of fantasy state. Now you learn that fantasy states are glad to be with you, and that's what your brain will reproduce. You've also trained yourself, instead of saying that I will not surely die, that, guys have certain needs, as it said, you know, which is if guys don't have certain orgasm rate per day, they're surely going to die. Well, you know, it ain't true. Is it a problem? Is it a tension? Is it a hard thing to deal with? It is indeed, and it's particularly hard to deal with if you have no social relationships with which you can actually be building joy. I ask you this. Take the average adolescent boy. Where is he going to get his affection needs met? Well, that's easy, isn't it? He'll crawl up on his dad's lap and say, "Dad, I need to be held today. I'm feeling really awkward about my body, and I haven't had any affection. And no one to kiss me and tell me how good-looking and lovable I am. And would you really, Dad, you know, tell me about how us guys really, you know, how you just love seeing a body like yours and your son, and I'll just hold you here and rock me until I feel better about this, because I'm feeling really tense and lonely, and I just don't know how to find joy today." Yeah. So given that easy solution, well, you know, how about the teenage girl? She's got a lot easier, doesn't she? Well, she can at least find all kinds of people glad to go after her body, right? Mm-hmm. Does that really solve the glad to be with you problem? Mm-hmm. Well, it really doesn't, no. The teenage boy thinks that if he found all kinds of people to go after his body, he'd be in heaven and he'd actually only be in the same hell that the girls are in. But you see, that's where we are. There's no sources of joy during those ages. And so, because there are none that can be thought of, there's no imagination, there's no group creativity trying to solve that problem. I mean, we just laugh and we think, I can't even imagine. You know, I mean, a few of us actually were teenage boys at one point, you know, and some of us even teenage girls, although I deny anything, any, you know, claims to that effect myself. But we realize our brains find an impossible problem to solve. If you're faced with an impossible problem to solve, no solutions, nothing that will provide anything, you're going to come up with something, okay? It will train your brain badly. It'll prepare you for nothing. And it'll also make it a lot harder to learn the thing you needed. But actually, you don't need orgasms that often per day. You do need joy every day. And without that, you're going to be in trouble. And we've never solved that problem. And as a result, we can't even address this issue. We'll add one more thing, and that is that in Western culture, we have decided, because we have no use for a large workforce and we've never prepared people to be adults, that we're going to delay the onset of adult from 13, when you start learning to deal with these things, up to maybe 30. In between times, you have people under the most possible tension with no known solution for that tension. And if you want to look at that, that's a formula for something that ain't good. And you're going to tell the average Christian boy or girl, now go out and solve that by being a good Christian. We'll give you no working solutions for it, but you better not use any of the solutions that we don't like. It's like telling somebody, here, you know, drink this bottle of pop, but please don't pee anywhere. You know, we just don't do that, you know. And sooner or later, something's going to go wrong. They may have to edit that out of the tape. Yeah. Yes, over here.
You described the scenario with the boy getting his father's lamp.
Yes. Okay, good question. I talked about the boy getting in his father's lap. Is it acceptable in the adolescent for the boy to be comforted by his mother? And the answer is that it's about as unlikely, but if there's a healthy bond, it would be just as possible from either parent. As a matter of fact, both your mother and your father need to be able to look at you and say, you know, I like what you have the good thing. You have the thing that God created you with, you have all you need to be a source of life of people around you. And if you look at Zephaniah 3:17, where it talks about, 3:16 and 17, it talks about God quiets us with his love. Now, the difference between lust and affection is that lust arouses you and love quiets you. And the mother as well as the father, if they have learned to do quiet together, is very wonderful for quieting you with your love. Now, the mother that doesn't know how to quiet, if she tries to hold her teenage son, you're going to have all kinds of trouble with that particular one. But it comes from having learned and practiced a life of learning both joy and quiet. Yes. Okay, does it help to tell stories? On this one, I can give you a very emphatic yes. As a matter of fact, it's imperative that you tell stories. When you have kids and you look outside and you say, it looks rainy out there, you better take your jacket, children realize you can anticipate what's coming up next. You give them something to do to take care of it. You better take your snack, your lunch with you because you're going to be gone all day. Then the biggest thing that ever hit them in their lives happens when all those adolescent hormones came along, and you never did what you did with them about the rainy day or anything else. You never mentioned you had this coming. They can come only one working conclusion. You haven't a clue that this was going to happen, and consequently, you have no known solutions for it, and you're the last person we're going to talk to you about it because you knew how to tell me it was going to rain today, and I couldn't see rain, or that it was going to be cold when I was, all those other things you could foresee. So anything you can do to tell your children stories about it ahead of time helps them to know, A, we can talk about it, B, we know it's going to happen, and C, we can recover from the things that go wrong because here's all the things that went wrong in my life and here's how God and the people around me helped me recover. It's very hopeful, hope-producing. And so I should say, by all means, tell the stories. Redeemed stories, if you please, but tell the stories. Yes. Over here, question. Just let me put you on hold a second. What's my time look like? Anyone know? Another 10 minutes? Oh, marvelous. Okay. Yes. All right. Okay, so the proposal is that we have to give some model to help children now who are getting married at 26 instead of at 16, a model of what you do in the meanwhile, and that's the change that's occurred in our culture. I'd say you also might add this to it, that when they get to 26, most of them are still functioning at infant maturity anyway, so they're getting married later, but they haven't not matured even to the degree that they might have previously by 16. And so by the loss of multi-generational communities and families, which is the means by which we would normally and historically transmit maturity, you say very few multi-generational interactions going on, very little community anywhere in America. So we've got people getting married later. They've got tensions. All the hormones are running. As you notice, the brain is wired to select your mate at 15 years of age. That's when it's hardwired to lock in on somebody that's going to be the person you love for life. That's, you know, when your attachment is going on. And what do we teach people to do then? To form temporary relationships. You see, neither in the church nor in society at this point do we value permanence. We don't date for permanence. We don't learn permanence. Everything about that age group, we say, is for transitional. See, our kids in college building anything permanent? Well, they're preparing to build something permanent, their career or something like that. Our kids in high school building anything permanent? Nothing's permanent. There's nothing important that they're doing. So what happens when you do that? And then on top of that, we have the absolute foolishness that we haven't bothered to notice, again, what Neil mentioned yesterday, and that is that any time you experience a sexual encounter with someone, you activate your attachment circuit. You've built an attachment. Now, I'm going to suggest something to you, and again, this may have to get edited out of the tape because it's speculative, but at least it isn't offensively speculative. One possible reason why we are not to commit adultery is the Garden of Eden. And that is, you remember when those angels were put on the door of the doorway, the entrance to the Garden of Eden, and we never could get back? You know that since that time, all people have sort of wished they could get back to the garden, to get back to innocence. It's been an unfulfilled desire in all of us. Well, God actually developed people and gave their sexuality such a wonderful characteristic that everybody has something in their sexuality that if you ever taste it, you'll want to go back. We, as I told you, the brain has no mechanism to deal with death. And the only way that you can deal with somebody who you have tasted and enjoyed is to kill them mentally, to have a death experience if you can't go back to them for the rest of your life. And so God would say to himself, if he was compassionate, why would I make people taste death over and over and over again with all these different relationships in which there's no recovery mechanism in their mind, in which they would bond, and the only possible way to do is to bring death into their life again, because they would want to go back to all of these partners. And this is what we struggle with. They come back into our mind. They haunt us. We have to have a lot of healing. God has to take us through that aborted birth, you see. It's like all these little abortions going on inside of us. And God says, you know, the only way I really want this to happen is I want you, if you ever taste some garden, to be able to at least enjoy that garden the rest of your life. Any wonder then that the Song of Solomon talks about it as though it were a garden. That you ought to have your own garden, and the one thing about your garden is you should always be able to get to your garden. Old or New Testament, it's that way around. And so I think it's really, in that sense, if you let someone into your garden that you're going to have to lock out later, well, you've just brought death into that part of their life. They'll always wish that they could get back. And so he says, only bring one in, because that's all that can have unlimited access to your garden. And that is how I would like it to be. And so we've changed that around to say, well, you know, sex is such a bad thing that God would only allow this such a terrible thing, and maybe in one context, then it'd be maybe all right. But everything else is terrible. I think it's exactly the other way around. God is the only one with the capacity to enjoy everybody. We haven't got that kind of capacity. We're going to overload ourselves. We're going to bring death into our lives. So please, only let into your life that which can be permanent. If we did that during those adolescent years, whatever it is that we're doing, we taught people to build permanence, we would be building something into their lives that they could at least handle. So I would say, if you're going to date somebody, whatever you do while you're dating, make it such that you will be able to maintain that relationship should they marry someone else. So you've built something permanent in your life. I think the most mysterious thing that ever happened to me, and this goes back in my own trauma history, was that I was sent as an adolescent to a Christian boarding school that shall remain nameless. And in that Christian boarding school, you were required to date periodically. But the worst thing that you could do in that boarding school was to say, I like a girl or I like a guy, because within a week you'd be sent away from the school. I mean, that constituted a special friendship, and those were not allowed. And so anybody who dared to say, I like somebody, was immediately expelled from the school, because Christians wouldn't do that. Now, this puzzled my adolescent brain something fierce, because I was supposed to date somebody, but they had to be sure to be somebody I didn't like. And why I should want to go and do something with somebody that I was for sure I didn't like, I couldn't make any sense of. And how you got from that to a satisfying life, I couldn't make any sense of. The whole thing just made no sense to me at all. And I got to admit that it didn't really help my get my brain wiring going particularly straight as well either. Because it was, again, a confusing set of rules trying to regulate somebody. No one was saying we want to build permanence here. And I always thought that permanent relationship ought to somehow grow out of the people that, you know, we like. So, again, things that we do to ourselves as the church, you know, just get kind of weird sometimes. Yes, in the back. Okay. Yeah, so the comment is that we need to perhaps have a better definition of permanent, because often we think when somebody goes out of our vision, we don't see them anymore, that they're gone. But we can still have a relationship that's permanent with someone that we don't see. As a matter of fact, I think that's how the thing started out with our Lord. Didn't he say, well, I'm about to leave you, and our relationship's going to be better off for it. So there's a great truth there. Yes, in the back. Okay, so the comment, to repeat it briefly for the tape, is that God gives us information so that we can make choices, and though there are parameters to the choices, it doesn't make it deterministic when we have that information we need in order to make good choices with what God has provided for us. Is that sort of a short summary of what you were saying there? Yes, in the front first. I see you back there. Okay, I'm going to have trouble repeating that all for the tape, so I'm going to say that there's comment has been made for us here that there's a different model between the world's model of how you have a group, and that leads to an individual relationship, or doesn't even, and how the Christian is supposed to have relationships within the group that leads to the ultimate courtship and relationship there. Yes, in the back. Yes, that's a very interesting question and comment. Why do the Christians believe that it's a body from the neck down, and you're glad to notice that something's wrong with it and treat it, but if the body from the head, from the neck up, has a problem and involves the brain, stuff like that, we as Christians want to run away from it and act like that isn't real body, you see, or something like that. And I don't think I have the answer to that one. One of the Christian worldview people like Dr. Tim Warner can maybe answer that one better. But I will tell you a very odd aside. I've gone into churches now, and I teach them joy based on the teachings and works of Jesus. And people go, oh, yeah, oh, uh-huh, fine, thank you. And they go on, and it doesn't motivate them particularly to change. I go into the same group, and I say, here's how the brain works, and it requires joy. And they go, oh, look at that. And then I say, and Jesus said we should do something about it. And they all go, wow, he was right. We ought to do something about that. And it's just really amusing to me in a very sad, sick sort of a way that I get a much bigger response out of the church by going in and leading off with the biology and following up with the words of Jesus than I do if I go in leading off with the words of Jesus. So we should have joy. I think probably because we have so spiritualized the whole thing and made it into information transfer and put it all over in our left hemisphere that when we talk about joy, absolutely nobody in the church really knows what we're talking about. And in fact, it wouldn't actually make relational sense. When we're doing this, we're actually talking a little bit about joy in a way that does affect us. And we can then say, that must have had at least something to do with what Jesus was talking about. Now, I don't say that was the only thing he was talking about. There's more to Jesus' joy than what we just talked about in the brain. But if it didn't include what we're talking about in the brain, then he was a pretty dumb designer. That's how I look at it. And I don't think he's so dumb. In fact, I think he's really. Oh, man. I'm admiring there. Yes, over there. Yes, right there.
The question we have about the patient lunch, is that like a weekly meeting with him, an hour a week? Or is this, what's the format that this whole, your presentation today is meant to be applied in?
Okay. The question is, do you meet with them once a week or what do you do? That has to do with how hard these ponies are to corral. Some guys are going to need to meet almost every day. And you can get a group of guys. And some guys can do once a week. And some guys will have to be talking with somebody else once a day on the phone. And then getting together with a group of people once a week. And I don't want to just say they're guys. You know, women often struggle with this on a daily basis too. And sometimes going a whole week in pain by yourself with no one else to share it is just flat too long to feel all the pain you can feel. And so you might need to have this on every few hours basis, you know. This is a really a custom program. You have to get as much as you need to do it. And when you're facing pain, it's often the case that early on you need a lot and later on you don't need as much towards the end of the 6 months. But the first few weeks can be pretty rough. And so, yeah, I don't dictate it for that reason, that every situation you have to look at in terms of what does this person or this group of people need. Are we out of time?
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to have to call it off right there. Thank you very much. And enjoy the rest of the conference.